Thank you. So I wonder if you guys have got some questions or would like to have some part of the discussion. We've got some microphones here, and there's a lady there in the front.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Hayat Sindi. I'm from Saudi Arabia. I'm a scientist, entrepreneur, and semi-politician. Thank you very much for the amazing presentation. And I have a question for Jackie and I don't know how to pronounce your name, Bjorn. Jackie, it's you know, I really love, I'm a very big fan of your work. But really the critical question, how do we really define what is sustainability? Because each country has different needs, had difficulties, and also there is different understanding of sustainability from the decision makers, leaders, and also the communities, the citizen. And how far are we from the awareness of the sustainability to the community? I remember when the word entrepreneurship, you know, was born, was like, it's a completely different culture for different countries and will misuse, because anybody who opened the cupcake, they say that is entrepreneur, which is completely different between some small businesses and somebody who is really as entrepreneur leading a change. And you, my question to you, thank you very much for your presentation, but it's very nice to look at numbers and data, and sometimes we can look at it in this very dry way. It's not linked to the community. And thank you for the example you gave at the end about, you know, the, I think a village in India wants something different. But how really, when you said how we can start, I mean, what about the local communities? My question, what about the local communities and how really they are will be drawn to, into the picture to decide for themselves what they really want to start? Because I believe also for the true innovation, it's come from the local community, because they know about what difficulties they face, and they are the best one come from that, from that region. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. I think that we've got caught in a trap of our own kind of intellectual normative thinking, in that there is only one scale and one solution for sustainability. It absolutely is not. And one of the good things about the Sustainable Development Goals is that there is a differentiation between things that need to be tackled globally and things that absolutely have their locus in communities. And even the INDCs are a very interesting proposition, because they have been written, yes, and submitted by governments, but when you read them, not only do they touch on actually many of the topics that Bjorn raised, these INDCs are not climate mitigation. They end up adding up towards climate mitigation. But if you look at what countries are proposing, they touch on virtually everything that's in the list. It's very, very interesting. At education, at agriculture, at land use, at water, and so forth. So I think my experience recently is that local communities are reaching out for things that should be provided nationally, regionally, and globally. And they have a real need for example, some facilitating conditions like the rule of law, like access to and education and health and so forth. But there are many things where local decisions have to take precedence. Water, fuel, energy. I mean, I can have exactly the counter argument that Bjorn showed in Africa, in the Maasai, where solar power is cheap, available, and actually gives you everything. On a light switch, a 24-volt home, we've got cooking stoves, you can even have a washing machine. This is all technology that was developed for the back of driving big, large trucks, where they run everything off 24 volts. So I really think that we should be careful about how we tailor technology, but we should not ever inhibit its availability. So for me, the sustainability still remains, working for the next generation, ensuring there are resources, but it will take a local solution maker. And that might be a community, it might be a regional authority, it might be a local authority, to translate what that looks like in the context. But there are things that we have to tackle globally as well.
Yeah, thanks for your question. I think there are two things for local communities to recognize. One is that we're very often driven of who has the best story. We were talking about earlier, you know, what's the most sexy thing? What's the thing people are concerned about, worried about, but that's not necessarily the thing that would actually do the most good. And so that's one of the things that we try to do with data, exactly to try to get people to realize, well, some of the things, for instance, indoor air pollution, it's very hard often to get people to recognize, because they like the taste of the food that comes with the way that it's prepared, but to get them to recognize this is actually really bad for them, typically the women doing the cooking, and for the kids who are running around inside the house often. At the same time, I think we also need to recognize this is much about global technology. So it's not just about the local. If you look, for instance, in air pollution in London in the late 1800s, we actually estimate air pollution in London cut about 20% of UK GDP, sorry, London GDP, because it was really mostly a London issue. Air pollution in London in 1890 was much, much worse than Beijing is today, although that's hard for us to understand. And one of the main reasons is because China now has access to much cheaper technology that's more environmentally friendly. They may not have bought that for that reason, but it was just the only one that was available because it's been developed also with environmental regulation at its head. So I think we need to recognize it's both about getting local priorities involved and getting them right, but it's also about getting the global technology drivers running. Just a very quick aside, I mean, if you look at US, China, and the EU, which make up about 80% of the promised reductions, that's almost entirely about coal out, wind, solar in, about energy efficiency in the case of China. I think it's a very, very charitable reading that it's mostly about education and
I didn't say that. And, all right, we're going to have a controversy now, right? I didn't say that. Don't misquote me.
Next question, please. We've got somebody here. You got the microphone there? Somebody has the microphone, so I guess who has the mic gets to ask the question.
So Damon Matthews from Concordia University in Montreal. A question for Dr. Lomberg. I appreciated your talk. You're a very compelling speaker. I have to say that fundamentally holding up climate against the development goals as an opposing or two choices is unhelpful. In investing in climate now may not have huge effects by 2030, but in the long term, so many of these development goals cannot be solved without taking action on climate change. And those actions need to be taken now, because the timeframes for transitioning the world to a carbon-free economy will take 50 years. And so we can't not invest in climate change and hope to meet the Millennium Development Goals later. It doesn't make sense. So why not identify those climate action strategies that do contribute the most to meeting the other goals instead of identifying the ones that don't?
All right. So let's just, I appreciate, I'm sorry, I couldn't hear all your questions. It's a very bad acoustics, but I think I got the main point that we need to focus on climate now, because unless we do so, we won't fix climate in the long run. Was that pretty much correct? We won't fix the other goals. Okay, good. So we actually, and this is a common misrepresentation of climate. There is a sense in which, and a lot of people, when they use this as a rhetorical device, they present this as, if we don't fix climate, we're all going to die. It's the end of the world. So clearly we should just allow anything to be pushed at that argument. If that argument was right, then yes, then we should be spending all our money on it. But that's not what the UN Climate Panel tells us. That's not what the economic models tell us. Actually, if you look at the UN Climate Panel's third report, which was published in 2014, their central estimate for what's the damage of climate change in total around 2070, the damage cost is somewhere between, as they say, and I quote, 0.2 and 2% of global GDP. Now, that's a problem, but it's by no means the end of the world. Let's remember, that's the equivalent of 1 year recession over the next 60 years. It's a problem, it's not the end of the world. So I would take issue with your fundamental premise, namely, if we don't fix climate, we will not fix all the other problems. Yes, we can almost get everyone off poverty, we can get almost everyone well-fed, we can do almost all the other good things without at all working with climate. Now, that's not what I'm suggesting we should be doing, but we need to be honest about the data and say, if we do something about climate, it's mostly because that is going to leave us a better world. Yes, it will, but it's marginal conversations. How much better? How much of the 2% GDP reduction in 2070 do you want to help? if you're going to spend 4% of GDP now to help a very tiny fraction of that, you've probably done a terrible mistake. You've made a terrible misspend. And that's the real issue. So I urge you to come back and tell the 3 million kids that you can save today that, I'm sorry, we'd rather buy a solar panel. And I think that is morally hard to do. And also, if you look at the numbers, actually a very bad deal.
Jackie, do you want to come back on that? And,
Well, I'm not going to get into a jousting match on numbers, but I, if I recall on your slide, you have one around removal of fossil fuel subsidies, and it was a pretty good...
It's 1,500 plus, yeah. It's
well,
a good idea.
Let's do it,
yes,
because
absolutely.
Actually removing fossil fuel subsidies will create a whole opening for all the other alternative forms of energy. So I hesitate to sort of, I'm sorry, I didn't get your name, but you, what you actually said, if I recall, was don't create false choices. I think that was more your point. Don't create a dichotomy that isn't there. So I find myself actually agreeing with some of you for the first time. I must admit this is an uncomfortable position for me. But let's just take the point that it's worth unpicking a lot of those numbers, because things that are today badged as climate change action are separated in your list. And I think that's where perhaps, you know, is a bit of hard sell on your part. But I think there's more common ground than there was maybe a few years ago. But I would contest you on the reduction of GDP. Anyway, that's another matter.
Okay, can I jump in?
Yuri, please.
If you look at the stresses on the supply side of water, you will find out that population growth and different distribution over the surface, namely urbanization, has a much greater effect on the stress that is put on the water resources. So that behooves the question that we should be spending much more attention and time on demand management, on the demand side. Efficiency, in terms of technology, pricing, education, rules and regulations, to bring into a better balance the two sides. So in water specifically, water and sanitation, you will find that, I will use a very strong word, the hype that is associated with climate change has lost the perspective that there are other stressors on the supply side which are much greater, and that there is basically a call to do more on the demand side. So I think we should take it in proportion.
Cool. There's a questioner here, please.
Nazar Hassan from UNESCO, and I'm also focusing on Mr. Lundberg's presentation. It's intriguing the way you presented the data, but we all know that the way you do your sampling, and I don't know where those 8 million people that you got in your survey where from, but if they were among those cities that will be disrupted by climate change, either by, you know, water level rising and stuff like that, I think definitely their choices would be quite different. So I would just like to, for you to highlight how did that actually 8 million people were sampled out of the rest of the world. The second piece is, thank you very much for the bad example you gave for that village being introduced to solar energy. But I think I'm getting a different message than the one you're trying to give to the audience is greedy multinational corporations, okay, they have garbage to sell to developing countries. And I have a lot of reports confirming those. So is a good message for us saying for those multinational companies to stop sending their waste to the developing countries and instead sending interesting, innovative technologies that can actually do a difference in those countries? Thank you.
So I don't know about the waste. I can't imagine that we would argue that anyone should send our waste to third world villages, but my point was much more, what should we send to them first? And I would argue we should probably send them the things they actually ask for rather than the things we feel virtuous doing. And so again, that comes back to your first question you asked. I should just say, this is not our survey. This is the UN survey for the Global Development Goals. They asked people around the world. Now, we can have a big quibble about who got surveyed, because this was Oxfam and a lot of other organizations who have actually reached out to people. A lot of them had to have internet access, so I would argue that they're probably it's been biased towards more wealthy people, and that was why I say, if anything, this was probably biased towards not so much focusing on the things of the very poorest people who probably didn't get on the survey. So if anything, I think this strengthens the point. But this is the official survey. Now, the other question that you asked was, but surely the people who are in cities that are going to be drowned by global warming would have a different priority. Well, there are two parts to this. First of all, we know from economic modeling of how you tackle sea level rise that no significant human population is going to get flooded. We will take care of that because it's a very, very cheap technology. And you know, the simple answer, but this is a little bit glib, is the Dutch knows how to, and they knew when they were much, much poorer. Of course, a much richer world. Remember, we estimate the average Bangladeshi will be about as rich as the average Dutch person is today in 2100. He or she will obviously know how to deal with a sea level rise of about a meter, even if it is a meter. So we will definitely take care of that because it is a very low cost in adaptation to a very high avoided damage. So we will deal with that. But the real issue, of course, is also to ask, well, if we then give those solar panels, if we do those adaptations, if we do the INDCs and all the stuff that we promised, how much will we reduce water, what sea level rise? Because we often have the implicit understanding that if we don't do something, all these cities are going to be flooded. But if we put up solar panels, magically all the water rise is going to go away. Of course it's not. Most of it will still be there. We're talking about a marginal change, and that's the marginal change that you're going to ask yourself, is that worth our focus? And that goes back to, and I'm sorry, I'm just going to make that one point, because it was Jacqueline raised it before, it was a false choice. We got to remember, it's a very, very real choice. The $100 billion that you were talking about will very likely come out to a large extent from development aid. And we know that because just recently, David Cameron and the World Bank and the US and China and a number of other countries have very explicitly said, we are going to spend some of the money that we used to spend on vaccinations and all this other stuff, we're now going to spend it on climate aid. So it's not a false choice. We're actually in the process of moving stuff from where it would do an enormous amount of good to places where it will make us feel really good.
I'm anxious to get a couple more questions in if we can. There's a gentleman back there with the microphone.
Thank you very much for allowing me to answer the question. I have rather a comment than a question. My name is Hani Suwayram from Egypt, and the issue is, I think also talking about the 17 SDGs or Sustainable Development Goals is sometimes confusing for decision makers. I do agree with all of them. I teach them for my students, but I also agree that we have to find a meeting point and to crystallize it for the decision makers so that they understand where to go and where to spend the money and how to collaborate with each other. I give you an example. The workforce globally working in agriculture is more than 40% of the people having jobs in agriculture. In developing countries, it sometimes reaches 60% of the workforce in agriculture. And agriculture is very linked to poverty. You know that most of the people working in agriculture are poor people. And once they don't have agriculture, they don't have food, and they are getting poorer and poorer. So agriculture is a key issue, but agriculture needs water, and water is very scarce. So if we solve the water problem, we solve the agriculture, and we feed people, and we avoid diseases, because diseases are very related to the quality of water. So we can narrow all these debates to certain points and move to agriculture and from agriculture to water. But we all researchers, we know that solving the energy problem will solve the water problem, because desalination is the way to solve the water problem. And I think this is clear. Recycling and saving and efficiency, they are minor issues in my point of view, but desalination is the key to solve this. And to solve desalination, you need to solve the energy problem.
I think we're getting the thrust of what you're saying. We're short on time.
The issue is about renewable energy.
I'd like to get some response from the panel to the suggestion that perhaps we should have a narrower focus.
Okay, I think you're right, of course, and I think if there was a sort of cascading way of making decision-making, energy would have to come out top. There is no doubt about it, the whole infrastructure and the way we deliver. But I just want to take up two other points around energy. You know, we are seeing across the world, and in Africa specifically, a move away from centralized grids to microgeneration. And so it does come back to this point of making sure that the affordable, appropriate technology is shipped and is available and is affordable. So remove subsidies, put technology on the front foot, invest in that. And I actually do believe a little bit, as Matt has said, that once you start fixing access to water because you've got energy to pump, whether it's desalination or not, you already can see this happening in many, many countries. It means that agriculture becomes by de facto a more efficient process of using water and so forth. So I am absolutely convinced that in the context in which the SDGs will be looked at a government level and at a community level, those choices will become absolutely apparent. So, but then you have to address other things like, you know, women's issues, access to the rule of law and so forth. But I think the context of the SDGs is such that we will have multiple ways in which countries will solve the indicator, so to speak. It won't be one fits all. And I think, you know, you talk about money shifting from one side to another. Don't forget that countries, including those in Africa, the one where I live, in fact, from their own domestic possibility and their own domestic finances, they are now stepping up to pay for finances. So the world of ODA is actually shifting. The world of FDI is shifting. And more countries are actually stepping up for their citizens to actually pay for things themselves.
And we'll just hear briefly from Yuri on this issue.
I'm a bit concerned about looking for technological fixes in the form of desalination, for example. Many countries cannot, and at a distance of 500 kilometers from the coast, it's not a feasible solution at all, because you can't get rid then of the brine. So I would look at the totality of the way in which supply and demand are managed. I would look more for efficiency in agriculture first before I went for desalination or any other technology. And I come from a country where more than half of our water is produced by desalination. So I am not against that as a fix, and we've been trying to convince our government for 2 decades to go that way because there was no alternative. But look at the total picture of the value of water in the urban and the agricultural and the industrial sectors and see what you should do in a balanced way. I'm concerned the technological fixes will take over as a caveat or as a solution for everything. Not that it doesn't have a role to play primarily in big cities like in northern Egypt.
Yuri, thank you very much. I think we've unfortunately come to the end of our time, and I don't think we can go on much longer. I would like to thank my colleagues here on the panel for their wonderful presentations. And Jackie, is there something very short to jump in with?
I just want to say about the marine plastics. I think it's a really great idea, but can I just hesitate one moment to endorse it with a big tick? It turns out that biodegradable plastic, when it hits the ocean, or bio-based plastics, just so the general public knows, actually causes a big problem because it sinks. I mean, you can imagine the one thing that's supposed to break down biodegradable plastics is sunlight, and then there it is, it goes to the bottom of the ocean and sits on the floor of the ocean and therefore doesn't degrade. So when you're planning to spin up your big, you know, consortium of Coca-Cola and the others, could you make sure that if they create supposedly biodegradable plastics, that it doesn't, that it's, it float, they take into account that it should float and not sink.
Yes, floating, not sinking, always a good idea. thank you all very much on the panel. Thank you very much for coming along. We enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Thank you. It was great fun.